I told you, please turn up the lights. That has sort of served to wake us all up. We have not done a great deal of work on computer analysis of the image in New Mexico. We are very severely constrained there by the contract between our employer and the Department of Energy. Namely, we are not permitted to use any of the government equipment for this work. So what little we have done has largely been places we've been able to beg a bit of computer time in other facilities, or a small amount of analytic work trying to outline what I believe is and is not a reasonable thing to do. What I want to do bring to you this morning are a few thoughts on what it does or does not make sense to do with computer image analysis.
Don, put it closer to your mouth, please.
Very early on when we started this project, we had great hopes that we would be able to bring forth very fine detail in an image. For example, questions such as, can you find more features around the wounds that can be compared with modern pathological evidence? Can you bring out any more detail in blood flows? I believe from what work we have done that this type of classical image enhancement is going to be an exercise in futility. As Don pointed, the other Don who was just up here, Don Lynn pointed out in his very nicely done color images, images of that type are very useful for going back later on and locating, or for locating in gross regions that you maybe want to study further. However, with the very high-quality photography done by the staff from the Brooks Institute in Turin, I have yet to find anything in these enhanced pictures that you are not able to find on the Brooks originals once your curiosity is tweaked sufficiently that you know where you wish to look on the original. So for this reason, I think any of you who are believing that computer image enhancement is going to bring forth detail on some particular feature that you wish to study are probably going to be disappointed. What good then is computerized image analysis on these images? As the previous speaker pointed out, you can extract vast amounts of numerical data. This data is then part of the solid physical information which you must be able to explain quantitatively with any model you choose to adopt for how the image may have been formed. So that, I think, is going to be one of the great promises of computerized image analysis. Simply the extraction of lots of data for comparison to various models of image formation. The other promise of computerized image analysis has to do with analysis in detail of the color of the image. As Don Lynn pointed out, in any one color, you can think of different intensities of image. And I want to speak of intensities rather than darkness, because darkness implies to us a color difference. But by intensity, I mean two things which are the same color, but one is more intense. In black and white, I think we can easily feature what I am trying to say. In black and white, you say an image is darker or lighter, but you're not implying any color difference. Transform this notion in your thinking to a non-color difference in a specific color. The eye is an exceedingly poor measuring tool for this kind of analysis. The computer, on the other hand, can discriminate different colors in the image because we did take photographs in a great number of different color bands. So by taking these photographs from the various color bands, merging them in the computer, we can certainly define a color quantitatively, thereby overcoming the limitation of the eye. And we can say, are different regions of the shroud the same color? Does something in the image have the same color as the background of the cloth? Does one part of the image have the same color as another part of the image? Thereby, numerically, overcoming the severe limitation of the eye as a color measuring tool. I do not, however, believe that we are going to be able, in New Mexico at least, to arrive at the full potential of this as an analytical tool until we are able to solve our problems of getting a very capable computer on which we are able to do this work. Therefore, my report is primarily, I think, one of a limited amount of frustration because we have not accomplished more, a statement of limitations on where I think the whole technique can go, as well as a statement of what I think it really is good for. One of the things I mentioned it was good for was extracting lots of data for comparison to various image formation models. Among other things, Don DeVan, the third Don of this bunch, has been thinking about image formation models. So Don, will you come take this over?
Don DeVan from Oceanographic Systems.
Thank you, Don 1 and Don 2. I'm not sure whether I'm technically considered a part of the normal community or normally considered a part of the technical community. I don't think it matters. As John mentioned earlier, my association with John Jackson goes back as early, I think, as almost anyone else's in the project. So in addition to the several kinds of interests I have in the unfolding of it, I have a paternal one. I remember, I guess whimsically, 7 years ago, thinking with John, and it wasn't even a pipe dream then, it was some level below that. We've seen there are in existence some number of rather elegant pictures of the shroud. They're beautiful to look at, they're full of information, but from an analytical point of view, they all lack the same thing. None of them have any way contained in the information, supporting information, to try to relate what one sees on the image, a quantity called film density, the gray shades, the differences in black and light or in colors, back to a more measurable quantity, something which might be able to shed some light on what happened or how did it happen or how much of it happened to make those variations in staining and intensity and coloration that we call the image. We decided that if we ever, some years, actually more than it turned out to be in the future, could take another set of photographs, that the hero of that set of photographs, the new type of image, would be something actually rather simple. You've seen them on some of the slides. It's a little device called a step wedge. All that a step wedge is a series of gradating shades, graduated shades of gray, each one of which reflects more or less light than the one ahead of it, and a known amount of light, more or less than the one ahead of it. In other words, we now know, in addition to how the film operates, how much after the whole photographic process, the light illuminating the object, the light reflected back from the object into the camera, the mechanics and the chemistry of creating film, of developing film to create these shades of gray or of color, we now will have some way of knowing how much light came point by point from the object being photographed. And we'll have one other thing, which is new to the history of shroud imagery. will have some way to do external experiments and, in a sense, make shrouds or make pieces of shroud or make shroud-like, hypothetically shroud-like stains, and then relate those back to the shroud itself. You might say that shroud images are answers in search of questions. The process by which we do this is conceptually a simple one. I wish I had some more graphics to enhance the presentation, but I think you'll understand it. In the laboratory, under some hypothesis of image formation, a series of, just call them stains, will be made, of discolorations on perhaps old linen, using whatever approach the chemists decide is a rational attempt to explain the mechanics by which the shroud stains are made. Along with that image, we will, alongside of that piece of linen or cloth, we'll place the same step wedge that we photographed time and again with virtually every shroud photograph that was taken. And we will then photograph those two side by side through the same camera setups, the same filters, the same lighting, or as close as we can approximate to all that, as we did the shroud itself. What we then have is some means to, in a sense, recreate the shroud image, to create a new shroud image, but now instead of the units, instead of the way that we measure the image quantitatively, as Don Lynn described, instead of measuring those in terms of how dense the photographic negative is, we'll be able to transform those measurements into how much of agent X, or what quantity or what intensity of agent X, or agent X is whatever we put on the cloth, would have had to have been incident on the shroud point by point in order to make that image. Then we can start perhaps asking questions as to, well, what does that mean? What is this new image calibrated in some physical unit instead of the film density unit? What could have made that perhaps? When one goes through a process like that, the parts that become interesting are the parts where something is changing. In terms of John Jackson's three-dimensional presentation, the curvature around the fingers, around the space where the nose departs from the face, the shape of those edges, the intensity of whatever the hypothetical image-causing mechanism and substance were, become things that can be directly compared or perhaps indirectly compared with hypothesis. To do this, as you might be able to understand, is an error fraught. It's a difficult process. A lot of assumptions have to be made. It takes quite a while to understand it, to correct it if necessary, to proceed from general attempts to more specific attempts. We don't anticipate having results from any of this kind of analysis for quite some time. I think you will all have to bear with us. It does give us a way to perhaps bring together the two parts of the shroud data analysis. Someone once said, and accurately so I think, that we can have done, as you'll hear later, we think a nearly definitive job in understanding the chemistry, understanding what happened to make a discoloration, something visible on the shroud in the first place. We can create a number of possible hypotheses, physical hypotheses for making shrouds in the first place. What we haven't yet been able to do is to combine a chemical hypothesis with a physical hypothesis to fit them together and say, yeah, that's convincing, that could have happened. And what I'm saying in a nutshell is that there is some hope, perhaps, or at least some avenues to explore with the imagery, the calibrated scientific imagery, to begin to address that so far hardest of problems to solve. So bear with us. You'll be the first to know, I suspect, if we come up with anything exciting.
Next, we'll hear from Dr. John Jackson again. He's going to give two presentations, which I'm going to ask him to combine into one because we're running late. One is image resolution characteristics, and the other is body-to-image mapping direction. And John, you're stuck because of the constraints of time to about 35 minutes for both. Can you interlock them?
Well, I can do anything. If we can go to Quinn and pull this off, I think we can, we'll try to do this.
Pull the mic out and put it to your...
Like this.
Right.
Okay. Before I begin, I was asked by an English professor if I really meant that stirrup was irreligious. He said that means against religion. What I meant to say was non-religious. Okay. Could we have the first slide, please? It's just before that. Okay, and dim the lights too, please, in the house. Okay, first paper, image formation considerations with respect to resolution of shroud image. This will be a paper dealing with looking at the shroud from a physicist's point of view. Next slide. And it has to do with the notion that the shroud image is very highly resolved. We don't see a whole lot of blurring, for example, on the image. Look at the lips in particular. I think that has physical significance, and I'd like to show you what I think that means. Next slide. I'm going to assume, this is an important point for the purposes of this discussion, that a cloth draped over a body shape, and then look at several possible image formation mechanisms with respect to that assumption, and then ask, are these mechanisms capable of giving you the resolution of the shroud image? But I am making the assumption that the cloth drapes over the body, over a body shape of some kind. Next slide. Okay. In particular, we have a profile of a facial form underneath a cloth drape. This form was in fact produced by biostereometrics data, which I will describe to you in just a little while. The thing we're going to ask is, how does information go from the body surface, in this particular example, the lips, and get distributed in some fashion onto the cloth? We can postulate physical mechanisms by which that might happen, and then ask various questions about it. In particular, we can ask, what kind of resolution are we going to see associated with that kind of a transfer process? Next slide. In this particular model that I'll use, I assume two surfaces for computations. The first surface down here, surface one, will represent the body. The surface two will represent the cloth. I have a specific geometry in mind, a coordinate system, where I put the origin at some point that I want to think of as emitting particles, let's say, of information that are going to transport themselves and arrange themselves on the cloth surface, surface two, to create shading of some kind. Next slide. Now, I know this is supposed to be a not too technical a talk, but I just can't resist. So I'll just give you a few highlights here, just to show that we do have some physics involved in here. The two mechanisms that I want to consider in sort of a generic sense are diffusion and radiation coming off of a body surface and creating an image. In diffusion, the particles get to the cloth by what's called the diffusion equation. The relevant thing here is the variable C, which is the numerical concentration, particles per unit volume, at any one given time in the as the transport occurs. The solution for this varies with position and time according to this relationship, and knowing that, then you can calculate using Fick's law of diffusion through a surface what the particle distribution will be on the cloth surface. And if we normalize that numerical distribution with respect to the total number of particles that will go to the cloth, then you can get a probability distribution as to any one given particle attaching itself to some point x, y on the surface of the cloth. Little d, which appears here and here, is the distance between the cloth and the body. that can be whatever you want from a mathematical point of view. In radiation, the computation proceeds differently. You say that there's a certain number of particles that are emitted from that surface, and I'm going to assume that they can be emitted anisotropically, and I control that anisotropy with the parameter index little m, and let me show you what that actually does in graphical terms. Next slide. Okay, little m controls how particles are emitted. If they're emitted with a very high m, the particles are emitted mostly in the forward direction, normal direction to the surface. If they're emitted with a low m, the anisotropy is less, and finally if m equals zero, you're totally isotropic, and there's no reason why I can't have fractional values of m, which give you something like this. Distributions with particles are emitted more in the horizontal direction than in the vertical direction. For example, radiation from metallic surfaces is like that. You have more radiation parallel to the surfaces than you do perpendicular. So we can include a lot of these in this generic model. But m is the parameter that controls the anisotropy. Let's go back to the previous slide, please. Okay, well, once the particles are emitted with whatever pattern they are going to be emitted with, and I can choose that, I let the particles be absorbed in the intervening space. For example, there is air in the assumption that a cloth covered a body. Air could act as an absorber of radiation. Okay, but I'm going to account for that with this little coefficient, little k. Once the particles arrive at the cloth, they can get absorbed, and I have no penalty mathematically for assuming that the absorption is anisotropic, that it would be absorbed at a more of a perpendicular normal direction to the surface than otherwise. Putting all this stuff together and then normalizing, like I did up here for diffusion, I can then calculate a sort of probability image for a particle of radiation, or radiation particle of radiation information, let's say a photon or whatever, for attaching itself on the cloth. The distribution looks like this. It looks, and it is, more complicated than for diffusion. But interestingly enough, if we let the parameters m, n, and k be zero, every one of them, this distribution becomes identical with this one. So I will only deal with this solution, and we realize that when we deal with diffusion, we just simply let m, n, and k be zero, and we're there. We're talking about diffusion as well, or isotropic unattenuated radiation. Next slide. Next slide after this one. Okay, now, I've told you how I'm going to model one particular particle making an image of itself onto the cloth surface. Now let's consider the relevant problem of 2 points, because I want to ask the question about resolution. How well are 2 points resolved onto the cloth surface? Okay, I'll have 2 points here, A and B, separated by a distance capital D. The cloth to body distance again is little d. These points will make the images of themselves on the cloth surface as we've shown, and I can plot the relative shading that is induced by this, by these patterns, by mathematical functions that look something like the following. I'll let f sub ab be then the joint probability function for particles making their presence from these points onto the cloth surface, irrespective of which point they came from. Next slide. Okay, now what does all that stuff look like? Well, okay, you've got a mathematical function here that describes this. It's simply a sum normalized with a factor of 1/2 to the two probability distributions that will show the attachment. And then, given this probability function, I want to say that the number density, or I can write that the number density on surface number 2, the cloth surface, is simply the number of particles that are involved times that probability function. That is simply a definition that I used before. Okay. Now, we don't look at particle distribution when we look at the shroud with the microdensitometer. What we look at is reflectivity. Okay. I think it's reasonable to assume, and I will assume, that the reflectivity distribution is simply a monotonically increasing function of particle density. The more particles you have, be it diffusion or the result of radiation onto the cloth, I will assume the simple function that it's that the reflectivity is simply a function of whatever number density you have. Now, the condition for maximum, or the condition for simply just achieving resolution of an image is given by the second derivative of this reflectivity. Let me show you what that means graphically. Next slide. Okay, we have several distributions here, and the second derivative means that the inflection point here gets level. At that point, you can no longer tell when you're dealing with two particles, because the essential distribution here is, as we see, one particle from one distribution. Next slide. Okay, this is the solution, which I won't bore you with. Next slide. I'll show it graphically later. I did some experimental results to verify that solution. This is radiation, and what we see is that the radiation images will blend themselves into resolution, where you can no longer resolve them at roughly a distance equal to the distance of separation from the cloth of the body, which is consistent with the model. Next slide. This is, again, we have the same results for resolution. We can see that we have no resolution here. We begin to have it here. Next slide. Okay, what is the resolution of the shroud image? Well, we've got the hands, which we certainly can have resolution of the fingers, but that's not a very well-defined point. So let's go to another place. Next slide. Here's the face, and that has the most variation, but I believe that the place on the shroud that has the most sensitive, or has the highest resolution that we can tell for sure, I think is the lips area. It's also fairly well defined because the cloth touches at that point and then makes a curvature over it. So relative to that point, and we can see that the image there is resolved, I think we can ask, could diffusion or radiation do this? Next slide. In the context of the model as I presented, this is the graphical solution of those equations that I showed you. Basically, it says that if you take a certain value of anisotropy and a value of absorption, you have to have certain values here in order to achieve a certain resolution given by the ratio of the distance of separation of the points that you're trying to resolve divided by the distance of the cloth to body separation in terms of this. It turns out that the shroud image, as I measured from photographs and doing biostereometric data measurements of cloth over bodies, that the image on the shroud has a value that falls somewhere in this vicinity over here. And that's just for minimum resolution. I therefore don't believe that it falls over in here someplace, about along in this area, for minimum resolution. But in that respect, I don't see that isotropic radiation or diffusion could in any way explain the image because of the resolution properties. Also, we were at the very limit of resolution as far as these calculations are concerned, but the images of the lips are very well resolved, and I suspect that we're operating in an area somewhere probably up in, you know, this way. So, next slide. Next slide. My conclusions would be then, I believe that the molecular diffusion, isotropic radiation are incapable of explaining the resolution of the shroud image, and that anisotropies in emission, absorption of the cloth, or attenuation of radiation could give required resolution that's sufficiently strong, but probably could produce unacceptable geometric distortions in the image. And this will be discussed a little later in the presentations. Okay, next slide. Next, and I think I'll skip a one or two. Okay. The last presentation I want to make is concerning some thoughts on the mapping direction from body to cloth surfaces implied by the two-dimensional layout of the shroud image. Next slide. Again, I will make the assumption that a cloth draped over a human body shape. Next slide. Given that assumption, one might ask, what is the mapping? In other words, what direction would the body image go onto the cloth image? That has not been a question we have addressed, but I think it's a relevant question, and it could be quite useful for further information analyses. Next slide. Okay, the backup one, please. Okay, first of all, we can say about the mapping function that it's a one-to-one mapping because the image is highly resolved. One point on the body maps to one point on the cloth. I think it's also fair to assume that the mapping function, whatever it was, that acted to produce the image was something that acted from the surface only. It contained surface information and no other information, say underneath the surface of the body. Okay, next. Oh, and then the last one is that the image is bilaterally symmetric. Okay, I can show that on the next slide. If you take two images of the face and their transparencies, reverse them, you have...